This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with industry experts and SG2 thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we all expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery.
We've got ourselves in this great opportunity to see truly how this incredible shift in care delivery, the reduction of volumes, the delayed care that we've thought of as standard of care, when all of that has been disrupted, we have this essentially national scale clinical trial at play, and know that the payers and the sophisticated providers are going to run analyses to determine which services actually added value.
Welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I'm your host, Trevor Durin. And today we once again have a large group of service line experts, a new group this time, joining us to talk about some of the common diseases and treatments that have changed due to COVID and what that'll mean for the near-term and long-term demand forecast for hospitals and health systems. So rather than introduce each of the five guests now, we'll introduce people as we go and introduce them as we're asking them questions. So we're going to jump right in here. Let's start with Ryota Terada, who leads our orthopedics team, knee and hip and spine surgery, STOP. And it's now starting again. What are some of the consequences of delaying or deferring care for patients?
I'm glad you didn't use the term elective here, because for that knee, hip, and spine surgeries that have been deferred or postponed, most of the time, these are for kind of addressing degenerative or painful conditions that patients have had to essentially live with for a prolonged period during this delay or deferment, and has had a substantial impact on their quality of life. We all know that as we've been kind of quarantined, we'd love to go hiking or biking or playing with kids or grandkids. These are things that are just that much more painful for these patients. And from a clinical standpoint, it may actually even exacerbate conditions. For example, neurological deficits or impending deficits that could be prevented by decompression. Well, for most patients, hopefully they were able to get that decompression done in time, but perhaps not. From a returning to kind of be able to get surgical care, this has impact for what does their prehab look like? How's their screening? What's happened to patient optimization? Will that have an impact on their outcomes when they do receive their surgical intervention? These are questions that we're monitoring closely. And from a financial perspective, a lot of our patients may have had a change in their financial situation. They may have lost insurance or they may be unemployed and ultimately decide that they're going to delay this otherwise necessary care for a longer time than would it be ideal. So a lot of impact from kind of delaying and deferring care.
Ryota, I can chime in too. This is Catherine from the medicine and surgery team. Justin and I were reading an article this morning on our med-surg team from the Wall Street Journal that was about Dayton, Ohio. And Dayton hasn't really been significantly impacted by COVID-19 in terms of infection rates or deaths. But they're certainly dealing with a lot of fallout in terms of economic circumstances and just fear of going outside and fear of having the virus have that surge and get worse. And that's really been impacting older Americans in that city of Dayton who are afraid to leave their homes. So when we think about things from the healthcare standpoint, there are certainly some short-term quality of life impacts for older Americans. For example, deferring things like cataract surgery has impacts on patients' ability to see, which can have impacts on things like delirium and other medical conditions. And looking at ENT, hearing loss is another key area here that impacts that older American population. And without having that treatment, it can have some serious circumstances and serious issues for quality of life for that patient population.
Absolutely, Catherine. This is Justin Cassidy, the director of the medicine and surgery team here at SG2. And we're seeing across the board, many different markets, any procedure that involves a mucosal membrane, because of the increased risk of potentially exposing the provider, the team, to aerosolized viral particles, those procedures have been delayed. So ophthalmology, ENT, urology, and gastroenterology are really seeing a lot of those hits. But as PPE becomes available, you're kind of hit with a second wave of dilemmas and delays, because patients that have gone into the COVID crisis with a scheduled procedure on the books, and sometimes we know with screening colonoscopy, that might be 6 months out. They went in with that scheduled, have lost their job, may no longer have insurance. So that access issue can be a real problematic. And the long-term front, we expect this access issue to be exacerbating conditions. The consequences of this mean that we're going to be catching cancer a lot later, thinking about screening colonoscopy, but also imaging, like low-dose CT scans for lung cancer. We'll start to actually have less surgeries in the near term, but more surgeries down the road, unfortunately, for cancers that will lead to poor outcomes.
Thanks. That's a good quick run through of some of the things impacting bigger procedures and surgeries. I'll look to Chad Geese and Josh Aker, who lead our CV team, to answer this first. Thinking about patients with chronic conditions that had to change their treatment pattern or didn't have access to diagnostics or minor procedures for the last few months caused their condition to exacerbate. Is this something that patients will bounce back from once the health systems reopen and they can get back to a more normal pattern, even if it's more virtual interactions? Or are we going to see some longer term impacts here?
Trevor, this is Chad Geese. And I think the answer is that we are going to see some longer term impacts here, particularly because the CV population is at increased risk for comorbidities or complications associated with COVID directly. Think about vascular comorbidities. Thrombogenesis has been kind of a big concern as of late, with increases in VTE and pulmonary embolism, as an example, rhythm abnormalities, carditis, and cardiomyopathy associated with COVID itself. The delayed management that you mentioned is particularly concerning for our heart failure population and our heart valve disease population. And those will have a longer road to rebound, as you had mentioned the term exacerbation. And that's exactly the concern with pushing off treatments and visits for management of these conditions. This is from Strata Decisions. Recent data suggests that 75% decrease in coronary heart disease is what was felt in inpatient outpatient encounters for looking at the March-April time period 2020 to the March-April time period of 19. 75% declines in coronary disease visits, 55% declines in heart failure visits, 74% declines in hypertension visits, chest pain the same. And so we're seeing care and management decrease, which will, I think, have longer term impacts.
And this is Josh Aker, also from the cardiovascular intelligence team. And some of the things that Chad is talking about also are a little bit upstream. So thinking about managing hypertension. If those patients have problems taking their medication, they have unstable or uncontrolled hypertension and don't seek, for example, medical care at an emergency room or an urgent care room because they're too scared to go out, that exacerbation is going to stick with them for a really long time and put them at further risk down the line, not only in the short term, but also at the long term. It will increase their risk, for example, of congestive heart failure. So monitoring and really treating these diseases, these chronic diseases, is really important, both in the short term to help out those patients and their quality of life, but also to prevent worse comorbidities, worse cardiovascular disease down the line.
And Josh, just a great point regarding hypertension. This is Justin again from the MedSurg team. We expect to see in the coming months and years an increased focus on the comorbidities leading to mortality in COVID-19 hospitalizations, and you know, hypertension really leading that list. So better managing in the outpatient setting will lead to better outcomes with those COVID-19 hospitalizations. The other comorbidities of note are obesity and type 2 diabetes, more than any other. Flu also can be caught along with COVID, leading to very dismal outcomes in some patients. Interestingly enough, underlying chronic pulmonary disease hasn't been as much of an issue, but we expect to see a lot of increased focus on all these chronic conditions moving forward. Catherine, anything in the long term?
Yeah, from a long-term perspective, it's definitely going to be a story of managing those multiple comorbidities and medical complexity. And a great example of this that's already happening but has important long-term impacts as well is end-stage renal disease. Mm-hmm. So patients with end-stage renal disease typically receive dialysis in in-center clinics, but that's beginning to change much more rapidly than we expected as a result of COVID-19. Many patients moving to home dialysis, and we've heard that DaVita is really moving many of those patients to having dialysis in the home setting. Yet it's going to be important to continue to manage those patients and their multiple comorbidities because it is a very complex patient population. Not everything can be shifted to virtual. So even though these patients can have their dialysis in a home setting, they still need to have in-person visits to check on their dialysis access point. So it's not a completely shift to home or shift to remote monitoring type of story.
That's a great point about changing sites of care, which leads to my next question, which is, you know, health system real estate overhead combined with the continued need for who knows how long to isolate COVID patients is really going to change the site of care, the footprint, the way health systems think about this in novel ways for different disease types and patient types. Let's go back to the CV team here. How is this going to affect site of care for CV patients?
I think the shift to ambulatory sites of care will be more top of mind for most health systems out there than it ever has been before. In the past, what we've seen is organizations working with independent physician groups or their own physician groups that are aligned with them to facilitate that ambulatory shift through ASC, ambulatory surgery center, and office-based lab, or the OBL model. But it's been primarily made for physician engagement, physician alignment, and financial reasons, lower cost of care, increased margins, et cetera. But now I think we have a real opportunity to think differently about how and where we treat patients, thinking about cohorting patients, thinking about creating the COVID-free zones such that we can keep some semblance of normal volume, normal rhythms with our physicians, workflows with our physicians, staff and patients, et cetera, to keep a normalized volume. And so I think these ambulatory sites or these shifts to ambulatory sites are increasingly top of mind. Josh, anything to add?
There's not only the ambulatory sites of care, and we've definitely seen organizations think about sort of testing three times. So calling and talking to the patient on the phone beforehand, doing temperature testing, or if you have the ability to do rapid COVID-19 testing at the door. And then when you're actually seeing the patient, going through a quick questionnaire about, you know, are you been exposed to anyone? Are you coughing? Do you have malaise? All sorts of just double checks on that. I think the other thing to think about is not only restarting procedures, but restarting those ancillary services. So for example, the American Society of Nuclear Cardiology has some guidelines about restarting nuclear imaging and stress testing. And so it's not only about how to think about the patient experience and thinking about scheduling, it's also how that workflow changes. So if personnel that were in these ambulatory sites have moved to the hospital, you're going to have reduced hours of operation. Organizations need to think about where PPE is being sent and used. Also, the tests are going to take longer because you need to clean down equipment ahead of time. So you're going to actually see maybe fewer patients normally, or will have to extend hours. And so really thinking about that operations is going to be critical. The other thing that I think to sort of bring back is how cardiac rehab, which Chad and I have been talking about for a very long time, really impacted by this COVID-19, because these are already sick patients. Usually some of them are recovering from major heart surgery. It's challenging to get them, even in the best of circumstances, into the hospital. But now those programs have shut down. And so, Chad, do you want to talk a little bit about what you're seeing with at-home cardiac rehab?
Sure. I'm glad you brought that up, Josh. The at-home cardiac rehab model has been in place for quite a while. We've seen it in the National Health System in the UK being very well supported. It hasn't been adopted here primarily because of payment. It's not covered currently by CMS. And so the at-home cardiac rehab models, while there are clear protocols that have been shared by organizations like Mayo Clinic, it is not something that organizations have been able to implement because of the cost and lack of reimbursement. But they sure are paying dividends right now, and organizations have started to adopt that model to continue to support patients and their cardiovascular programs as a whole, as you think about the value cardiac rehab offers to your surgeons, your interventional cardiologists, your heart failure physicians. And that model, I think, we'll see stay. We'll see that become a long-term part of a cardiac rehab program, even once the in-person clinics begin to open up.
And I can chime in as well on this topic of sites of care from the surgery perspective. A lot of what Justin and I cover in medicine and surgery are procedures that have already shifted to the ambulatory surgery center, but one area that really hasn't so much to date is general surgery. So things like hernia repair, cholecystectomy, and appendectomy are still predominantly done in that hospital environment, whether it's inpatient or hospital outpatient department. So we're anticipating that COVID-19 is going to accelerate the trend of those procedures moving to ambulatory surgery centers, like Chad was saying, because of that feeling of wanting to have a COVID-free environment. And also that coming not only from providers, but from patients as well who are seeking out sort of a separate site of care.
Chad, Josh, and Catherine, excellent points. Just to reiterate, the physical facilities will look different moving forward. There's going to be such an increased emphasis on clean care facilities associated with acquiring COVID-19 in these settings. And as we think and look to other sites that have opened in our communities, there's now forms to sign when you're going to stay at a hotel, eat at a restaurant, or even get a haircut in many of these markets. We expect to see, you know, similar sorts of initiatives, and how that plays out in the end is going to be really interesting to follow. But in the short term, anything that can allay the risk of acquiring COVID is going to probably, we'll see an uptick of utilization. Thinking about those drive-through clinics, it's a no-brainer. But also the fact that there might be two parallel systems of care for a lot of different types of services. Thinking about the emergency department in particular, and how some have actually segregated their units based on patients that are experiencing upper respiratory illness versus those that are experiencing everything else that normally goes into an ED, and thinking about just how that facility design is going to look and feel very different than pre-COVID.
And this is Rita. Those are great perspectives. The contrarian perspective, though, is also from the orthopedic side. We're hearing that the volumes first coming back often are actually even the hospital cases. Certainly, they're trying to keep it to be COVID-free or kind of minimize the risk of COVID infections. But from a patient perspective, they might not understand the difference between an ambulatory surgical center and a hospital campus and which one may have lower risk or not. So in those markets, we're hearing that the cases they're coming back are really those that are clinically urgent or really from the pain perspective, just intolerable at this point for patients. And that's what determination we're making. They're going all or nothing. And that's why hospital outpatient departments coming back first. But from a longer term perspective, I think that transition to the ambulatory surgical centers will accelerate because of the experience that we're gaining to truly drive same day discharges. From orthopedics, certainly we've led the way and kind of transitioned to outpatient in recent years. But it's become now a clinical imperative to figure this out, while as in the past, there might have been resistance from some providers of the outcomes and the risks with trying to rush patients out from their perspective. But now it's becoming really an advantage from a clinical perspective to minimize the time during a hospital environment. So that experience really sets up kind of growth in the ambulatory surgical center space in the future as well.
I don't know how you guys did it, but you managed to talk about site of care shifts without talking about virtual, so that we get to kind of have that conversation separately. So well done. Let's dig into some of the diseases, treatments, or new care patterns that are going to really shift to virtual. I mean, virtual care kind of jumped in a time machine here and leapt 3 to 5 years into the future, which I know we're particularly excited about. Justin and Catherine, there's so many diseases that you guys cover under general medicine. Give us a few that are going to experience a big shift to virtual.
I think to start, just anything that can be medically managed can shift virtual, right? It really lends itself to that shift. So there's just a whole bunch of different things that could fit in that. Minor infectious disease, a lot of that already has shifted virtual. We've talked about that last year. Things about like allergy medicine absolutely can shift virtual. Another big one that we're seeing, perhaps the biggest, is men's reproductive health. So thinking about erectile dysfunction medicines being prescribed via apps or third-party vendors, this is a really important one because it disrupts the urology business strategy. So instead of building a men's health clinic, as had done in the past, dispense ED meds to patients, and then use that as a sort of channel for the downstream urology procedures. Well, now these third-party apps are kind of taking that upstream referral strategy and shaking it up a bit. In fact, we're predicting a one-year 63% shift to virtual for men's reproductive health visits. So this is going to truly change that business model forever. Now, thinking about how these online companies make their money might be informative for our clients. They're not in it for the E&M visit revenue or the downstream procedure volumes. They're actually essentially online pharmacies. They're basically manufacturing and prescribing generic medicines, packaging up really pretty, and then charging a tremendous up fee. The visits are sort of at scale via an artificial intelligence or virtual questionnaire that patients answer to rule out any sort of clear contraindications for those medical prescriptions.
And adding to that follow-ups visits perspective, orthopedics, I think that's the key area for virtual visit shift that's probably here to stay. Traditionally speaking, orthopedics and spine care has seen a lot of resistance in shift to virtual visits, particularly because there's a lot of actual physical manipulation that you need to do for assessments and looking at functional outcomes. Out of necessity, the transition to virtual has really accelerated in the orthopedics realm. But now that states have reactivated their services, clinics are reopening or have reopened in many states, I'm hearing a mixed bag of continued adoption from orthopods that love it. They've had really a great experience with the platforms they have. But more than that, the kind of team-based care they were able to implement has allowed them to be more efficient with their practice. They mentioned that between visits, even between scheduled visits, in-person visits, they're able to now fit in virtual visits. So they maximize their time from patient perspective. They're hearing that the patient perceives that they've spent more time with them, even though on the timestamp, it actually says they've spent less time with them. So from a patient perspective, it's a great value and it's great for providers. On the flip side, for those that haven't had that same experience where this has actually been less efficient and in some cases less personal, they've pretty much passed it on to their PAs and stopped doing virtual visits themselves. So I think we're going to see a little bit of return back towards the norm for some of the orthopods. But that said, we've gotten a glimpse of what's possible. And I think that's really important looking forward. One very insightful comment from an orthopedic surgeon was that at least for preoperative care, they would really need to see patients in person. When the patient comes in for their care and they're going to go under a knife, they're essentially putting their life in their hands. So they would not foresee a situation where they don't see the patient in person altogether. So there is a limit, but that said, there's been an adoption rate that I would have never thought possible just 4 months ago.
3 years ago, I had an ACL repair. I'm still on the email list from my physical therapy office, and they've gone completely virtual doing Zoom visits. And so even that post-procedure from your orthopedic perspective, they've made that transition. For CV services, for that chronic disease management, we've been fairly slow to adopt virtual consults, virtual visits. And that, I think, is changing and will change for the long term. And just one example, the Heart Failure Society of America a few weeks ago published a statement in support of virtual visits for a broad range of heart failure patient types, both reduced ejection fraction and preserved ejection fraction patients, even those with VADs and heart transplants, they're supportive of using virtual consults as a way to manage these patients. So new patients and existing patients, they are encouraging providers to find new ways to interact and to support them. And so that alone says to me that virtual consults, virtual visits will become a more prevalent part of patient interactions moving forward.
Yeah, Chad, I think for CV, you're right. We've really not been at the leading edge of adopting this virtual care model. But I think now, because of COVID-19 and creating that structure really across organizations, have brought cardiologists and vascular clinicians into that fold. What's also enabling the ability to do this is a lot of the wearables or at-home monitoring devices. we've already done the remote monitoring for a very long time in the cardiovascular space for implantable devices with remote device clinics. But now with things like at-home EKG readers, Bluetooth-enabled scales, automated blood pressure cuffs that connect to your phone. There's a lot of different ways that patients can check in with their physician virtually. And if they're stable and monitored, maybe we are replacing some, but not all of the face-to-face visits. And so I think there is definitely going to be a maintenance of what these patients are going to be doing within the virtual healthcare space.
We've got ourselves in this great opportunity to see truly how this incredible shift in care delivery, the reduction of volumes, the delayed care that we've thought of as standard of care, when all of that has been disrupted, we have this essentially national scale clinical trial at play, and know that the payers and the sophisticated providers are going to run analyses to determine which services actually added value and improved long-term outcomes. And it's a great opportunity, something we never could have gotten past an IRB, but here we are. And I think we'll be able to use this to really determine which services are value add and hopefully put together care redesign initiatives to support those that truly do add value and improve outcomes for our patients.
That's a nice concluding thought, Chad. I can't say it any better. So thanks to all the guests who did a fantastic job of covering a lot of ground quickly. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Please subscribe or follow if you want to hear more. And I always recommend another Vizient podcast, Modern Practice. It's on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. It's led by Dr. Tom Villanueva, colleague. Does a terrific job and provides a more clinical perspective into some of the current issues affecting healthcare today. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. Look forward to have you join again in the near future. This has been another great episode of SG2 Perspectives, where industry experts and SG2 thought leaders explore the drivers of tomorrow's healthcare strategies to inform today's decision makers. Contact us anytime by sending an email to sg2perspectives@sg2.com. We'd love to hear from you. SG2 revolutionized healthcare demand forecasting with the Impact of Change forecast, and today we're the industry's premier strategy advisory firm. To learn more, visit sg2.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.